This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, February 20th. From Washington, D.C., I'm Tanya Snyder, sitting in for Aura Bogado. In today's newscast, Sri Lankan rebels bomb government buildings while peace groups ask President Obama to support the Tamil ethnic minority, another financial fraud scandal brings more bad news to investors, and mayors from around the country get their mandate from the president. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with today's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. 30 people have been killed in a suicide bombing in Dera Ismail Khan in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. It's the second attack in the last 2 weeks in the town. Combined, more than 60 people have been killed and more than 140 injured. Rose Katabchi reads this report from Gabe Matthews in Pakistan.
The bomber blew himself up when people were gathered for the funeral of a Shiite leader who had been assassinated the day before. Last week's attack was during an annual Shiite observance. This time, the suicide bomber targeted the funeral because mourners didn't gather at the site of yesterday's targeted killing. Harris Khan lives close to where the bombing occurred.
People are poor here. They cannot afford to buy food for their families, so how can they buy bombs? These terrorists are not local people. Sunnis have very close and warm relationships with Shiites, and we condemn this.
After the bombing, an angry mob began protesting and setting Sunni-owned businesses on fire. The government imposed a curfew due to the fear of sectarian violence, with an order to shoot violators issued to the troops. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Pakistan, this is Rose Katabchi for FSRN.
Zimbabwe's Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai is in South Africa on a mission to acquire economic aid for his ailing country. The visit comes at the same time that a new unity government is almost fully formed. Davison Makanga reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
South African President Halema Mohlande says his country's finance minister will meet next week with an African Development Bank official and the finance minister of Zimbabwe to discuss an urgently needed recovery package. New Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai said he would welcome aid from any country. Meanwhile, President Robert Mugabe has sworn in several new deputy ministers as part of the new power-sharing unit government. However, the ceremony was overshadowed by the absence of Movement for Democratic Change official Roy Bennett, who has been in police custody for the past week, facing charges of banditry and terrorism. Tsvangirai says the charges are politically motivated. The deputy agriculture minister nominee has a bail hearing next Tuesday. For FSRIN, this is Stefan Makanga in Cape Town, South Africa.
The European Parliament has denounced 14 EU member states for their involvement in the CIA's extraordinary rendition of 100 detainees. The resolution, welcomed by Amnesty International, comes 2 years after the Parliament's report on European complicity in illegal renditions. Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
The European Parliament said that EU member states bear a particular share of political, moral, and legal responsibility for the transportation and detention of those imprisoned in Guantanamo and in secret detention facilities. According to the report, Sweden, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Britain, Italy, Macedonia, Germany, and Turkey were responsible at varying degrees for violations of the rights of specific persons. Germany has rejected the charge. The report found 7 other countries, Ireland, Poland, Romania, Spain, Cyprus, Portugal, and Greece, could be held responsible for collusion, active or passive. It's also suspected that Poland and Romania may have harbored CIA detention centers. The Parliament also criticized European states for the involvement of their own officials in interrogating prisoners of Guantanamo or other detention centers, thus legitimizing the existence of these facilities. In Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Thousands of residents living in India's slums marched through the streets of New Delhi today, demanding an immediate end to home demolitions and legislation guaranteeing shelter and protection against forced evictions for the urban poor. Bismillah Gilani reports.
Workers and trade union leaders joined Delhi's slum dwellers in today's protest march, demanding the right to shelter. People living in Delhi slums have been protesting demolition of their homes for years now. The demolition drive in the city has intensified since the government began preparing for Commonwealth Games. Delhi will be hosting the Games in 2010, and to make way for a Games village, nearly 25,000 families have been evicted in the last 4 years. Protest organizers say none of the affected families have been given replacement housing, despite assurances by the authorities. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
And following up on a story from yesterday, in the face of community protests, the New York Post has issued an apology for a cartoon of a chimpanzee being shot by police, which some said was a veiled racist reference to President Barack Obama. To those who were offended by the image, we apologize, said a statement in the Post. But in reference to the Reverend Al Sharpton, who organized the protest, the paper's statement continued, however, there are some in the media and in public life who have had differences with the Post in the past, and they see the incident as an opportunity for payback. To them, no apology is due. Sharpton and others plan to continue protesting until the cartoonist is fired. And those are today's headlines from Free Speech Radio News. From Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been tapped to form the next government of Israel and will likely return to the post of Prime Minister. During his first term leading the country, Netanyahu allowed new settlements and froze the Oslo Agreement. His negotiations with Egypt and with the Palestinian Authority bore little fruit, but he did turn over most of Hebron to Palestinian jurisdiction. Meanwhile, it's been 4 years since Palestinians began their struggle against Israeli settlements and a wall through the West Bank town of Bilin. FSRN's Hassan Banora reports from the protest on the anniversary of the start of the struggle.
Iyad Burnat is the head of the local committee against the wall and settlements construction in Bil'in village near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. He and the residents of Bil'in were conducting their weekly protest. But today is a bit different. It is the fourth anniversary of the village's struggle against Israel's building of a wall and settlements here.
We feel it is unjust that the occupation started to steal our land for their settlements. So we formed a popular committee, and since then we have had weekly protests as a form of nonviolent resistance to the construction of the wall. Through this, we were able to deliver a message to the world that this wall exists to steal our lands and not for security reasons, as Israel says.
The appointed Palestinian Prime Minister, Mr. Salam Fayyad, and other Palestinian MPs visited Bil'in and joined the Friday prayers in the village. Dr. Mustafa Al-Barghouthi is a Palestinian MP.
Bil'in provided a model. The model is specific. It's about being creative. It's about solidarity of internationals with the people of Bil'in and their participation in every demonstration. But above all, it's about consistency and continuity. That nobody gave up. Not a single Friday was missed. That means the model is working and it will spread all over the occupied territories.
As is the case each week, international and Israeli peace activists joined the protest in solidarity. Also, a member of the popular committee against the wall in Na'lin, a nearby village, joined the protest. Salah Al-Khawaja from the Na'lin Committee Against the Wall and Settlements Construction says Bil'in was the model for their own weekly protests, which started over a year ago.
BLN's struggle succeeded because of the creativity, continuity, and self-dependent work. We in Nihlin and Al-Masara villages and other places learned from that and have based our struggle upon it.
An Israeli army unit was stationed behind the wall and prevented the crowd from going through the gate by firing tear gas canisters, causing dozens to suffer gas inhalation. Five were injured by rubber-coated steel bullets. Jonathan Bullock, an Israeli activist who comes to Bil'in weekly, said it is his duty as an Israeli to come and help the Palestinian farmers to protect their land.
As an Israeli, it is my duty to be here. What is being done here is being done in my name. And if I don't come here and actively resist it, I'm part of it anyway. But if I don't come here and resist it, That's the minimum requirement of Israelis, to come here and actively stand with the people against what the Israeli government is doing to them.
In September 2007, the villagers continued protests and the legal proceedings, managed to get the Israeli Supreme Court of Justice to order the construction work at the annexation wall at Bel'in to a halt. The court ruled for a rerouting of the wall section built on Bel'in's land. Due to the ruling, the villagers got back 275 acres of the 600 acres the wall was planned to take over. As the protest ended, people near Iyad Burnat home and his friends danced Dabka, the local folk dance for Palestinians. They promised more protests to come until all their land is back. For Afasaran and IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Banoura in Bel'in village.
FSRN's Ghassan Banoura was one of the dozens caught up in the Israeli tear gas attack on the peaceful demonstration. He was treated for injuries and reports that he is doing okay. Sri Lankan Tamil Tiger rebels who are boxed in a pocket of land launched a stunning air raid in the capital Friday night, local time. A government office near the Air Force base was damaged in the attack. FSRN's Pinia Manikavasagam has the story.
Military officials say two rebel light planes carried out the attack, injuring 44 people, including two airmen. Sanjeev, a trader, has been waiting for a bus about a kilometer away from the scene of the attack.
Suddenly the lights went off and the firing started. With that, a plane passed over our heads, and suddenly there was a big blast, and we saw flames somewhere near the railway station or the Air Force base.
Defense spokesperson Kehliya Rambukwela says one of the rebel planes has been shot down by Air Force planes. A dead body of the pilot also has been recovered by troops. Friday's raid was the first bomb attack on the capital since October, when a power station on the outskirts of Colombo was hit. The renewed rebel air attack is seen as a major embarrassment to the government, which has claimed to have destroyed all the hidden runways and put the rebels' tiny air force out of action. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ponnaiah Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
As the humanitarian crisis and violence continues in Sri Lanka, American and Canadian citizens of the Tamil ethnic minority arrived in Washington to rally on Capitol Hill. This follows rallies in London and Toronto, where some are calling the attacks on Tamils an ethnic genocide. Among the hundreds gathered Friday by the White House seeking President Obama's support for Tamil people was one 17-year-old who has become the movement's core leader. Sam Greenspan reports.
They go, so what do you eat today? And I would go, oh, nothing. Why? I'm on a hunger strike. And so that would cause them to ask, oh, you know, why are you on a hunger strike? And it would raise awareness that way for our Tamil people who are being killed by this Sri Lankan genocide.
Priya Sundaralingam is a 17-year-old high school student from Winchester, a suburb of Boston. Priya recently finished a 12-day-long fast and came to D.C. to join hundreds of peace activists demonstrating by the White House to demand U.S. support for Tamil people in Sri Lanka, the so-called safe zone that the Sri Lankan government is using to detain 400,000 displaced Tamil people, has been the target of bombings and shootings by the government. For Priya, the matter is a personal one.
I was born in the States. I'm an American. The reason why, like, I'm so involved in this is because, you know, my entire family is from there. I'm 100% Tamil. My roots are all from there. And, you know, I've grown up kind of in a Tamil community. You hear about, you know, people's stories, their struggles, how they got out of the country. If my family wasn't fortunate enough to get out of the country, I managed to survive all this time, then I would probably be in the same situation that those 400,000 people are in right now. And so I can't just sit there and do nothing. I have to do something.
Working with the human rights group PEARL, People for Equality and Relief in Lanka, Priya is the youngest of the 8 core members, who are mostly college students. She's also the only of her colleagues in the Boston area, which led her to take on a substantial role informing her community about the condition of Tamil people in Sri Lanka.
We kept emailing the media every day. You know, every day I would spend about 6 to 8 hours on the computer alone. I got yelled at so much by my mom. My mom would go, Priya, go study, go do this, go do that. And I'm like, no, I need to contact the media. I need to bring out some kind of a media outreach kind of thing.
Priya's work has managed to attract some attention, including from Senator John Kerry, who will be meeting with Priya next week.
Senator Kerry read about me in the Boston Globe, and his office contacted me, and so we're going through with that. And hopefully I can do whatever I can to bring an end to the genocide in Sri Lanka. These are poor, innocent civilians who did nothing wrong other than being born Tamil. I'm an American, and I hope that the U.S. government can step in and do something about it.
Despite the presence of a small counter-demonstration from the Sinhalese ethnic majority, Priya and the Tamil peace movement hopes that their voices may reach across the ellipse to President Obama's White House. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Greenspan.
President Obama met with 85 mayors from across the country to discuss spending the $787 billion stimulus package. States are eagerly anticipating the money for projects, but they're finding that it comes with strings attached. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Parts of University Boulevard in Wheaton, Maryland are on deck to be repaved by the state with money from the economic stimulus package. Local resident Lauren Washington says it's about time.
It's jacked up with a lot of potholes. I work in transportation, so I drive a lot of different vehicles, and those potholes do a wear on your tires. And hopefully, if they use the money the right way and fix it, we shouldn't have no more problems.
States are also getting money for social programs like Medicaid, unemployment, and food stamps. In addition, there's a big chunk going to infrastructure and the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund that provides money for education, public safety, and services for the elderly and people with disabilities. Many states, including Maryland, are anxious to get going. Sean Adamek is spokesperson for Maryland's governor. He says they'd like to get started on updating the state's light rail, subway, and airport.
Many of these projects are projects that have already been awarded, but the only roadblock is because of a lack of resources prior to the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. There hasn't been what's called a notice to proceed. And now that those resources are available, that money is almost immediately available within, you know, the next few weeks, and in the language of the bill, those projects had to be so-called shovel-ready within 120 days.
But there are conditions. The White House Office of Management and Budget has released a 62-page memo on how states can apply for funds with federal deadlines and reporting regulations. In some cases, states will have to apply through competitive grants. Some of the regulations have not even been written yet. Executive Director of the National Association of Counties, Edward Salazar, says counties have lists of projects as well, but they're not clear on how to get the stimulus money.
Those lists need to be taken to the right place, and those lists need to be taken to either federal government regional offices or to state governments. If it's a federal agency directly because it is a competitive grant, then we need to know that. So there are a lot of questions that we are needing to have answered.
One of the key stipulations for states getting money is transparency. States are being urged to set up their own websites so the public can watch the funds. President Obama speaking to a group of mayors today in the White House.
What is required in return, what I will need from all of you, is unprecedented responsibility and accountability on all of our parts. The American people are watching. They need this plan to work. They expect to see the money that they've earned, that they've worked so hard to earn, spent in its intended purposes without waste, without inefficiency, without fraud.
The White House will have a team of managers monitoring how the money is spent, and the administration has also set up a national website, www.recovery.gov, for citizens to monitor how the money is being spent as well. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Another financial fraud with global implications is emerging. Alan Stanford's offshore banking business defrauded investors to the tune of $9.2 billion. The SEC filed charges against Stanford on Tuesday. Joining us to unravel the mystery of the fraud is Mike Baker, president and co-founder of Diligence, a global business intelligence firm that investigates financial fraud. Mike Baker, thanks for being with us. So to begin, it's been reported that Stanford's banking business provided improbable, if not impossible, returns to investors. Now, how did he do this?
Well, yeah, it all sounds very familiar, doesn't it? I mean, coming on the heels of the Madoff scandal, which again was based on the notion that people by nature they forget. If it sounds too good to be true, it likely is. Now, what he was doing was through his bank in Antigua, which was the key part of his business empire, he was encouraging investors to invest in certificates of deposit, as what he was referring to them as. But he was essentially saying that they were very liquid assets that would be invested in very stable, low-risk products and investments around the world. By definition, if you have a highly liquid, low-risk investment, you know, the end result is a low return. I mean, that's what you're getting. For low risk, you're getting low return. And so he was essentially lying to his investors about the nature of both the investments that he was working with, and also, in a sense, he was falsifying returns to them.
How does this compare to the tactics that Madoff used to defraud his investors of their money?
Their tactics were similar. They tended to kind of cloak themselves in exclusivity. So they both set high entry barriers. You know, not just anybody can invest in my funds is what they were saying. That exclusivity makes it attractive to a certain investor out there, and they're willing to suspend disbelief at certain times because they think, I just desperately want to get into this opportunity. Both used auditors for their massive operations that made no sense. Madoff, his brother-in-law, was his auditor operating out of a small office down in Miami. Stanford's auditor was, this elderly retired accountant living and working in a small office in England, in London. And, you know, if you were going to look at somebody and say, maybe I should invest my money with that person, it's incumbent upon you as an investor to take the time to understand what you're getting into.
The SEC says that they've been investigating Alan Stanford at least since last summer, but there are reports that there were a whole myriad of government agencies that spent more than a decade investigating him and came up with nothing. How did he pull the wool over the authorities' eyes for so long?
It's not so much how Stanford was able to pull the wool over their eyes. It was the dysfunctional nature of how regulatory agencies can work at times. The regulatory agencies have a very difficult job at times, but there's no doubt, both with Madoff and with Stanford, and these won't be the last cases, indicators were missed. Basic fraud indicators were missed. Their schemes aren't new. These have been done over the years, and the problems have been repeated over the years, but the scope, the scale, the size of these problems is staggering to a lot of people. So there will be an increased effort on the part of the regulatory agencies to monitor and to try to get a grip on some of the other issues that might be lurking out there.
Mike Baker, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
That was Mike Baker, president and co-founder of Diligence, a global business intelligence firm that investigates financial fraud. In Cambodia, one of the most notoriously brutal regimes in world history went to trial this week. It's been 30 years since the Khmer Rouge was in power. Under its rule, an estimated 2 million people were killed through starvation, disease, torture, and execution. The first to be tried at the UN-backed tribunal is a man known as Doik, who headed up a prison known for torture. From Phnom Penh, Kortith Him reports.
Under a drizzling rain in the early morning on Tuesday, hundreds of people gathered in front of the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia, or ECCC. They are here to attend the trial of Gangit Eu, also known as Duch, a notorious commandant of the Cambodian genocide. Victims of genocide, Buddhist monks, journalists, all waited patiently outside the courtroom. The 66-year-old Gangit Eu is the first defendant. He was the commander of the Tuol Slang prison known as S21, which sent at least 16,000 people to death in the killing field. Gang Yu is charged with murder, torture, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. Helen Javis, Chief of Public Affairs of ECCC, says the trial is a big move forward.
We've been working very hard to prepare for today. It's a very, very important day in the history of Cambodia. We think it's the most important thing that the trial has opened. We know we have to work as quickly as we can because the people are getting older, the people who may be tried, and also the victims themselves who are waiting. They're waiting to see the justice, and they are all getting older. But it's been complicated because this was the first mixed tribunal.
Pok Khon is a genocide survivor from Siem Reap province.
Since I'm a victim who survived the genocide and still have painful memories of it, I feel very excited to see the ECCC open a trial on Duch today. I do hope to see and bring justice for my relatives who have died.
Saint Thierry, another victim, agrees that it is a historic day.
I think as a Cambodian, as a victim, I think this is a very special day. It's a momentous day that it's historic because it sets the wheel of justice turning. It provides the momentum for the trial proceedings to move forward for the other senior Khmer Rouge leaders who are currently detained.
According to a study of Yale University, in the 4 years of Cambodian genocide from 1975 to 1979, 1.7 million people lost their life. That was 21% of the country's population. But not everyone is happy with the trial. Son Chai is a survivor of genocide and a parliamentarian representing the opposition Samrengsi party.
We don't believe that this kind of mixed trial will bring justice to all those who have suffered severely under the hand of the Khmer Rouge. We believe this showcase of tribunal will not bring any satisfaction result to those who have suffered.
The current trial is the result of a decade-long strained negotiation of the United Nations with the Cambodian government. Human rights activists believe the Cambodian government has been deliberately slowing down the trial. Many powerful people in Cambodia have dubious histories which the government wants to ignore. For Free Speech Radio News, this quoted him in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments at fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Headlines editor Andrew Selzer. And the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Puck Lowe and Rose Katapchi. For Out Abogado, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington, D.C.